From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
It's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. And we're just pleased and honored to have Monsignor James Murphy, Jim to a lot of you folks, join us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. Nice to see you.
Good. I remember introducing you one time at some dinner, and I said, I don't know what Monsignor means, but I looked it up, and it says a big deal.
There you go, a big deal. I think it's passed. That's passé. Well,
explain that title, though. It's a title.
Yeah, I guess it means literally my lord, which is definitely a part of the past.
Sounds kind of British.
That's over, yes. It's that's the age of triumphalism.
Yes.
We're done.
Yes, indeed. Well, lots of reasons to have you on, but I should tell people we're 20 years now into the Bishop's Hour, and you were one of the reasons the Bishop Hour happened.
I remember it was fun getting that organized, and I remember at the time people were nervous at the idea of having a live show.
Yes.
This is a live show. If he says something, he can't take it back.
And
I said, what's wrong with a live show? We're all alive.
I remember someone saying, oh, what happens when some wing nut calls? It happens.
Yeah, it happens.
We don't have any of those in the church, of course.
Of course not.
It might be somebody else calling. And we have you on today to talk about this wonderful new book from Ignatius Press. We're very fond of Ignatius Press. So they do a lot of great titles. Saints and Sinners in the Cristero War. And it's just out. Hot. I mean, my copy is still warm.
Right.
This is something dear to your heart.
Yes. I've been interested in Mexican history going back to the 90s, really. And the strange, phenomenon that a country that's so Catholic would have such a history of persecution of the church.
Right.
And back in the 90s, I was visiting a family in Mexico City, friends of mine, and their dad had been a rebel in the Cristero War. He's still alive. He had fought in the Cristero War. He was then 80 years old. And so talking to him and talking to them about him, I became aware of this war that went on from 26 to 29 in Mexico, and he was an actual soldier in that war, on the Catholic side, of course. And then he wrote a private memoir for his family, for his children and grandchildren, about his memories of his fighting in that war in central Mexico. And in one part of it, he describes being up one day in the mountains, facing the withering firepower of the federal troops and defecating in his pants, literally. I mean, this was a spontaneous rebellion by Catholics, and they just grabbed whatever they could find. They grabbed rusty old guns and machetes and pitchforks and just attacked the local barracks. But then when they overcame the local police, they would take over the barracks, get their horses and their guns, and they gradually built up a bit more strength bit by bit. The war went on for 3 years. By the end, there were enormous losses. I mean, the federal troops had lost 12 generals, 90 colonels, and 1,800 officers. It was huge losses. They were losing 1,000 a month. I mean, it should have been squelched in a month. It was just local riots.
Right.
But it gained momentum. Such was the anger of Catholics at the time because of the level of persecution of the church.
Wow. You know, growing up in California, but I remember taking a trip to Mexico. My dad was a grad student and was doing, he was in a botanist and he was collecting plants from Mexico. So we all went down as a family. And we'd go to Mass, and he'd say, Mexico is such a Catholic country. And it just since I was a kid, and all my friends who were of Mexican heritage growing up in California were such devout Catholics. And when I first heard about the Cristero War and the persecution of the church in Mexico, it just didn't ring right. It was like, wow, you just don't think of that. Of course, Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Yeah, it's crazy, and I deal with this in the book, of course. That question comes up in your mind: how could a country so Catholic end up being with this history? And Plutarco Calles, who who was the president when the war broke out, was literally a fanatical atheist. It goes back to the colonial history of Mexico. Mm-hmm. During the colonial period in Mexico, all the Spanish monarchs were Catholics, mm-hmm. starting with Queen Isabella. And they were active Catholics, and they were sincere Catholics. And they considered it their responsibility to convert the Indians of Mexico. That was their part of their mission,
right.
going there. As a result of that, they got privileges from the Vatican, a number of privileges, like they would have a say over the appointment of bishops. Uh-huh. They'd have a say over the diocesan boundaries, the building of new churches, even the publication of papal encyclicals in Latin America. They could veto them. They could mm-hmm. veto them. Mm-hmm. So there was this partnership going on between the official Catholic Church and the civic state in this mission, joint mission to convert the Indians. When Mexico finally achieved its independence, that issue of church-state relationship came up right away, because the independence of Mexico, happened because of Miguel Hidalgo. He was very Catholic, and the whole movement was Catholic to get away from Spain. But eventually, radical revolutionaries took over, and they brought up the question: why do we have to be so Catholic? Why does the Catholic Church have special status? Mm-hmm. Why can't we have separation of church and state like they have north of the border? Mm-hmm. That brought the issue up, and that's how it ended up in a polarized situation with both sides dug in, and ultimately led to the Cristero War.
Did the United States have an influence or a position on the Cristero War?
They did. The United States, their policy was they would not sell arms to guerrilla groups. And the Cristeros, for them, was a guerrilla organization against the official government of Mexico.
So, this would be Hoover administration, probably?
Yes, further back, yeah.
Yeah.
Calvin Coolidge was actually...
Coolidge, yeah.
Was the one, under him, they mm-hmm. solved it. But if, people have said if the Cristeros had been able to get arms, they would have toppled the government of Mexico.
Sure. So... was it confined to one area of Mexico?
It was. It was confined to the center and west. Mm-hmm. So states like Jalisco, Guanajuato, Colima, Zacatecas, all very Catholic states.
Did any mercenaries from the United States get involved?
No. No, not to that extent. But they were watching it, of course, and ultimately the United States was directly involved in solving it. Mm-hmm. What happened was Coolidge sent he had Sheffield as ambassador to Mexico, a man who couldn't stand President Calles, no time for him. So Coolidge sent in a new ambassador, Dwight Morrow, mm-hmm. and he said, look, we need somebody who can get on better with Mexico. We don't. He said, keep us out of war with Mexico. That's what he told him, keep us out of war with Mexico. Dwight Morrow was a very, very interesting man. He was Protestant, of course, but he sympathized with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. He sympathized with the role of religion and culture in people's lives. And so he sympathized with the plight of the church in this persecution. At the same time, he knew how to get on with President Calles. He knew how to drink scotch with him, mm-hmm. play cards with him, humor him. And so he had empathy for both sides. He had empathy for both sides. And that really was instrumental in reaching an agreement. Meanwhile, a priest, Father John Burke, a Paulist priest, had been working for the United States bishops in Washington, D.C. He was their chief staff person for the Conference of Bishops. He was interested in this situation as well. So when Dwight Morrow was appointed, some Catholic friends of his said to him, you have to talk to Father John Burke in D.C. Mm-hmm. This man knows a lot about the religious question, and the religious question is key in Mexico. It needs to be solved. And Morrow talked to Burke and was immediately impressed with Father Burke, really impressed with him. And says, I agree with you, it's serious. This church-state thing needs to be solved. Mexico will never advance unless it is. So the two of them hit it off, began to work together, and through their hard work and all these secret back-channel meetings and secret meeting places, they pulled off an agreement that ended the Cristero War.
Wow. So prior to the Cristero War, could people still go to Mass? Could they...
Yeah, well yes, what led to the actual rebellion was a very unusual act. The persecution of the church had been reaching incredible dimensions. There was a 1917 constitution which had basically banned the church from Mexico. That constitution was terribly anti-Catholic. Went as far as saying that the church has no legal status. We don't recognize the church as a legal organization. Church could not hold property, priests could not vote, could not make any comments whatsoever about public affairs. But the biggest thing of all was the Constitution gave each state legislature the power to decide how many priests would operate in that state. So in Guadalajara, for example, the state would decide how many, the priest had to have a license, like a doctor or a dentist had to have a license. So the state had the power to decide how many priests would serve in this city, not the bishop. Mm-hmm. Now that's what led, that's what horrified everybody and led to the to a most unusual act. The Mexican bishops on July 31st of 1926 did something unprecedented in the 20th century. They suspended worship in every single church in Mexico. They said, wow, as of this date,
wow,
churches are closed, priests are going to leave and just go and hide, and there would be no masses, there would be no funerals, there would be no sick calls, there would be no weddings, there would be no church bells, those comforting timekeepers that mm-hmm. marked off the hours in every square in Mexico for 400 years.
Yeah.
Now, this shocked the ordinary Catholics in the pew. The Catholics in the pew didn't understand the legal niceties of the 1970 Constitution. They did understand this.
Yeah,
he's taking away our priest. And they didn't blame the bishops. They blamed President Calles mm-hmm. because he was the one with this incredible record of anti-Catholicism. When he had been governor of Sonoma years earlier, he had banned every Catholic priest from the state of Sonoma. So they knew this guy's record. They blamed him. So in pure desperation, and August 1st and 26th, that was the first day the churches closed, there was just this spontaneous rebellion. It was just isolated riots in different isolated towns. But it just gradually grew. At first, they laughed at it. There were reports coming into Mexico City to the military, and they were just laughing at the mm-hmm. thing. But then a general lost half of his division. And then a general got killed, and it got more. It just escalated. And then they saw this is no longer a joke. It should have been squashed in a month.
Oh,
it went on for 3 years.
So was there any foreign influence at all? In the United States, you said no. Were there any other?
No.
Not at all?
Not really. It was just a spontaneous rebellion from people over the atrocities that were being visited against the church.
I'm imagining, you know, I think, oh, the sympathies of the United States would be with the Catholics, and yet in the 1920s, the state of Oregon banned Catholic schools.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
So,
and
the Klan was still active. And
oh, yes. And President Calles had his admirers mm-hmm. in the United States. He wrote an op-ed, actually, for the New York Times at one point. I think it was 1925, you know, justifying his acts. And he was being, you know, applauded uh-huh. by people like the Ku Klux Klan and the old, yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So when peace was achieved, what was left?
Well, the tragedy of this whole story is that the government didn't abide by their promises. They got, you know, they worked out a deal. Dwight Morrow and Father Burke did. With what happened was, Calles went out of office in 28, mm-hmm. 4 years his term was, and they hadn't yet arrived at an agreement. So then his successor, Portes Gil, was the one who actually signed the agreement. But Calles was still the power behind the throne. Mm-hmm. The subsequent presidents, three in a row, were all puppets. Up until 1933, they were all puppets of Calles. Calles was the real power. So it was Portes Gil. The agreement that they came to was that the government would recognize the church as a legal entity. Yes, mm-hmm. they would say, okay, it is a legal entity. We recognize it as a significant force in Mexican life.
Mm-hmm.
And they also agreed not to take revenge on the Cristeros soldiers. They allowed them to go home. take their guns with them, and go home. However, the agreement was barely signed when they began to ignore the whole thing, because the radical wing of the revolutionaries, totally ignored the agreement. Mm-hmm. They took revenge on these Cristero soldiers. They continued to harass churches, parishes, and it meant nothing.
Mm-hmm. When did that all end?
It ended then. It gradually ended under Lázaro Cárdenas in the 1930s, mm-hmm. mid-30s. It would have ended. Yeah.
And the church now, would you describe it in Mexico as flourishing?
It is, clearly the Catholic Church in Mexico, the faith of the Mexican people is extremely strong. It's stronger on average than we are, mm-hmm. stronger Catholics. I think it's because of the persecution. Mm-hmm. The Constitution is still the one in force, the 1970 Constitution, but it has been amended. Mm-hmm. It was amended in the 90s under Carlos Salinas, and the really, bad anti-Catholic provisions were taken out. For example, when Pope John Paul went to Mexico that first time, he had all those public masses in stadiums. Those masses were technically against the law, mm-hmm. because the Constitution said you cannot have any religious services outside the church buildings. Mm-hmm. So that it became a kind of a joke between Carlos Salinas and the journalists. And they said to him, "Well, are you aware, Mr. President, that this is illegal?" He says, "Sure, I'd be happy to pay the fine to the government." It was a joke in those days, but he did update the Constitution. So, but at the time, a diplomat, one of the Vatican diplomats in Mexico, said Mexico is living under one of the most anti-Catholic constitutions on the planet.
Wow!
That was before he made the changes.
Even more, of course.
And that was like in the 90s.
Great Britain doesn't have a constitution, but it had some some pretty anti-Catholic.
Oh, yes. And writing about Miguel Pro, for example, and others, I mean, I brought back memories to me of Thomas More and the religious orders in England, hanged, drawn, and quartered.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the heroes. And Toribio Romo is a Sacramento connection.
Toribio Romo is one of them. He's got a large family in Sacramento. He was a priest of the Archdiocese of Guadalajara. He was a very simple country priest who was assigned to tequila, which is mm-hmm. where the famous drink comes from. Right. Then comes the name. This comes from the drink, or vice versa. He was assigned there at the end. That was his final one before he got killed, at the age of 29, I think.
Wow.
26 maybe. He didn't stay in the rectory in the town of Tequila. He stayed in a canyon outside the town. He was in hiding, basically. And at this point, he was in hiding because he was on the list. He was mm-hmm. being hunted by the federal police. And he ministered to the people in this canyon way down. You had to walk down into the canyon, about 50 minutes walk down into it. And the local people there, of course, knew and didn't say anything. And he had his catechism classes, his masses, and he used an old tequila facility. It had been used to make tequila originally, and the family gave it to him. It was an old warehouse and mm-hmm. some beat-up buildings. Eventually, somebody betrayed him, or someone with a loose tongue said too much, and they tracked him down. And they came in one morning, it was right before Holy Week, I think, and they shot him in his bed. Mm-hmm. They shot him in the bed, yeah. That was him. Miguel Pro was one of the most colorful characters. He was a Jesuit in Mexico City.
That's a famous name.
Miguel Pro, yes. He's
maybe
best
people
known.
Can't say exactly who it was, but that's a name that people recognize.
Very famous, yeah. He, because of the situation in Mexico was so bad, he had to leave. The Jesuits sent him out of the country, plus his classmates, about 13 of them. They ended up in Los Gatos, mm-hmm. out near San Francisco, for a year. In the novitiate there. Then they moved him to Spain, and he finished his theology studies in Spain, was ordained in Belgium.
He's a Mexican native, though?
Mexican native. His father was a manager in one of the mines, the silver mines. Mm-hmm. And so Miguel Pro saw the labor, exploitation of the labor firsthand. Anyway, he came back to Mexico then after a year or two after ordination, which is in itself just a whole story, why he would come back and face certain death. He knew this was going to be death.
Yeah.
It was like those Jesuits coming back to England under Elizabeth, or the Jesuits in North America coming back during the persecution by the Huron Indians,
right.
Remember?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I mean, this is a Jesuit tradition. Came back. He was an actor. He was a tremendous mime and a mimic, and he just a tremendous actor. He talked his way into getting through the immigration at Santa Cruz. He just brazened his way through it and got through. They didn't detect him, even though he had been saying Mass on the ship all the way over. Everybody on the ship knew he was a priest. He was saying Mass every day. He still got through. Came to his superiors in Mexico City, checked in, and they appointed him to Holy Family Church in Mexico City. It's still there. It's the Jesuit church, one of them, in Mexico City. And today it's a museum to him. For a year and a half, he said Mass in Mexico City and gave out communions and gave retreats, even though he was on the most wanted list. He kept slipping through their hands. They would almost catch him. He'd talk his way out of it and he would escape. One morning, for example, 6 o'clock in the morning, he's going to this private home to say Mass for a group of people. He would say they were illegal Masses, of course.
Sure.
He was doing this at the risk of his death. And they were going there at the risk of their lives. So he arrives at the house, 6 o'clock in the morning. They're all inside waiting for him. He sees two police people at the door of the house. So he pulls himself together, and he happens to have a pen and a piece of paper in his pockets. He pulls out the pen and paper, walks over to the two policemen, and opens his coat very quickly, as if showing them the badge, flash it fast, and then close it again. They thought they saw a badge. And he says, "Something funny going on here?" and he takes out the thing and takes down the number and the address of the house. And he said, "Let me go in and see what's going on." They saluted him. He goes in. Goes upstairs to the group of people, terrified upstairs. They know that there's police outside. He said, "Calm down. Just stay here. Wait here. I'm leaving. There's no Mass, obviously. I'm leaving." And then just gradually leave one by one after I leave. Goes back down to the entrance, leaves, and gets a salute as he leaves.
Oh, wow.
That was Miguel Pro.
Have they made a movie about him?
They could.
They could. It sounds like it.
They could, yeah.
Wow. So what was his role ultimately?
Miguel Pro's role? Well, of course, he was then a very famous martyr. He became a martyr overnight. The funeral had 20,000 people at it, which must have been huge frustration to Plutarco Calles. But then Calles made a huge mistake. Calles decided he wanted to make an example of one of these priests. These are the subversive priests who are undermining my administration, and it's the problem with all of Mexico's problems comes down to this. This Catholic Church and these priests who organized the rebellion, and they're organizing the people against me. Let's make an example of him. And so he called in the journalists and photographers to witness the execution. And so they came in. Photographers photographed him being shot.
Which is the famous photographs.
Which are the famous photographs. You'll find them on the internet because they're not in the book.
And it's Miguel Pro. That's just P-R-O.
P-R-O, Miguel Pro. The photographs went out in the press. The press of the world ran the photographs. And instead of causing sympathy for Plutarco Calles and the Mexican government, it caused shock.
Yeah.
The world was shocked that a civilized society and government would shoot priests without formal accusation, without trial, nothing.
Right.
So it had the opposite effect. He made a huge blunder.
Wow. Does he classify as a martyr?
His case is still going through, and the others are officially martyrs. Mm-hmm. They're canonized.
Right.
So officially,
right.
Miguel Pro is.
Right.
Romo is.
Right.
Pro is not yet, and the reason is there's just a little more work to be done because his brother was involved tangentially in the Cristero Rebellion. Mm-hmm. And then there was also an assassination of the new president. Obregón had just been elected, and he was assassinated. And apparently there was an attempt on his life at first, and Miguel Pro's brother's car was used. Now, in actual fact, they weren't involved in violence, but they had connections to the Cristeros. So, and that makes it a little bit more complicated. The key thing for canonization is you can't have used violence. Any of those that use violence or automatically will never be saints. I think they're admirable people, but
yeah.
I mean, you have to, and I think it's a wise thing for the church, you have to be nonviolent.
Right. So in if the two miracles, we wouldn't know with Pro if he was tricking us.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Except for martyrs, you don't need any miracles, you know. Yeah,
that's right. Martyrs don't need miracles. Right. That's right.
No, he was a tremendous character.
Wow,
Pro, tremendous character.
How interesting. Who were some of the other heroes?
Well, then Archbishop Orozco from Guadalajara. He was the Archbishop of Guadalajara during this time. He was exiled five times. Exiled either from his residence. And he had to go into hiding or from the country. And for a number of years, he ran the archdiocese from hiding. He was actually hiding in the hills. And he would not stay with the big, wealthy hacienda owners because it was too easy to track him down there. He would stay with the Indian in the Indian huts. Mm-hmm. It was almost impossible to know which hut he was in or where he was.
Right.
And so he would stay with them. And, you know, a huge personal sacrifice. And one night he describes he's staying in this very poor hut with these Indians. He's sleeping on the floor. It's a dirt floor. And he's reading his prayers by candlelight before he goes to sleep on this dirt floor in this little cabin. And he suddenly sees a snake crawling over his feet. And he has to stay quiet and let the snake move on before he continues his prayers. A tremendous personal sacrifice. He also, like Pro, escaped several times from being arrested. They would get close to, they were looking for him, of course. He was obviously on the most wanted list. He was one of the most prominent members of the Mexican hierarchy. He was extremely articulate, very commanding presence. He filled the room when he walked in, and he was, of course, a tremendous critic of the government. So they resented him and feared him. Several times they came close to arresting him, but the federal troops very often would just give him a pass. Mm-hmm. These were all Catholics anyway. These officers or these soldiers, federal police, and they let him go. So he said at one point he said, I'm protected by the reverend silence of 15,000 of my parishioners. 15,000. Eventually they caught up with him, arrested him, and deported him. Yes, over. So the bishops in those days were staying in San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They had all been exiled, basically. Mm-hmm. And they were meeting in San Antonio, Texas.
Wow. So in addition to Caius, who were some of the other villains in this?
Well, the villains, of course, there was, what's his name, the first one there, Melchor Ocampo. Melchor Ocampo was a revolutionary in the previous century. You see, the history of this whole thing goes back to the War of Independence,
mm-hmm.
And it was, of course, heavily influenced, eventually, the new government was, by the French Revolution and by the European Enlightenment. The European Enlightenment, that you can figure out everything by reason. European Enlightenment was good. It was,
right.
You can figure out things by reason. You can figure out the laws of nature by reason. But it went much too far in the French Revolution. And religion became unreasonable.
Right.
And so, you know, it's celibacy is unnatural. Ban it. Right. Fasting is stupid.
Right.
Priests shouldn't be allowed to encourage people to fast. So religious orders were banned in France. The revolutionaries in Mexico took a page out of that playbook,
mm-hmm.
and they basically reenacted the whole French Revolution in Mexico during the War of the Reform in the previous century. It was a very polarized situation where you had liberals, not the same as our understanding
right.
of liberals. Liberals in those days, a liberal was a person who was against all religion,
mm-hmm.
and believed in reason. Religion was superstition,
right.
and it was directly influenced by the French Revolution. Conservatives were people who loved the Spanish heritage, the Spanish, the church, the faith, and their inheritance from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So it became very polarized. Melchor Ocampo was one of the first ones earlier on who went to Europe, studied in Europe, came back, and became familiar with that whole movement and brought those ideas back. And he came to the conclusion that Mexico's problems come down to the religion and the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
He was involved in the writing of the 1857 Constitution, and it was very anti-Catholic too. So the foundation of the whole thing began with him.
So do Mexican school children, do they study this? Do they know about this?
Very little. A little bit more now than they used to. No. That's the strange thing about this, is that if you talk to Mexicans today here in Sacramento who grew up in Mexico, they'll tell you they heard nothing about this in school. Uh-huh. And the reason was that the Cristero War was so tense and so polarized that you couldn't talk about it. You just couldn't talk about it in class, that the mm-hmm. class would divide down the middle,
sure.
depending on their parents. I had a similar experience growing up in Ireland. Growing up in Ireland, we never heard anything about the Irish Civil War mm-hmm. because it was so recent and was so bitter.
Right.
They just stopped teaching history right before the war started.
Wow.
That's what happened in Mexico.
Wow. So, and here in the United States, growing up here, going to public school, I've never heard of any of this.
In fact, no. Almost, see here also.
Here's a country on our border. It's been there forever on our border. Almost no Mexican history in our curriculums.
No. That's the surprising thing, is that people are surprised to find out that this happened. You know, one problem, I personally feel strongly about this. I do feel that, and I've taken courses in Mexican history, that the secular universities here tend to give a version of Mexican history which blames the church for everything.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the revolutionaries here, that they're being echoed here.
Sure.
I don't think it's fully fair. Now, I do think that the Mexican church made mistakes. I think that the Mexican bishops in the 19th century made mistakes. For example, you can say that in the War of Independence, the Catholic bishops and the Catholic Church officially was not sympathetic to Mexican independence. They just ended up being on the wrong side because of the polarization and because of the French Revolution and the horrible ideas. They went the other way. But that meant that they were against Mexican independence and in many cases against social progress.
Mm-hmm.
So they were accused of not being concerned for the poor. There was a big change in the next century, in the 20th century, due to Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum. That famous encyclical came out in 1891.
Right.
And it had a huge impact on Mexico. Because Mexico it was a fertile ground there. Mexico had a terrible social problems with the mines and the industry,
right.
and the foreign companies in Mexico were exploiting the workers. I mean, basically, most people work 7 days a week and for minimal wage, especially in the mines. People
right.
in some of the mines, those Indians just got their food for pay. If you go to Zacatecas and take tours of the silver mines in Zacatecas, they'll tell you this, and it's incredible.
Wow.
I mean, these poor Indians living and working in these conditions for no pay. So it's obvious what the Pope was talking about.
Right.
The bishops and the priests then in the 20th century took on Rerum Novarum, and they put on workshops about it. They talked about it, and they made the people aware. The Rerum Novarum is to that generation of priests what Vatican II was to my generation when I was starting off. You know, we all came out of seminary, all full of Vatican II. That's caused a renaissance in Mexico, and the bishops became much, much more socially conscious. They got Catholic unions going. And they had all kinds of proposals about banning child labor, having better conditions, having insurance for workers and so on. So they were now competing with the government. The government had these programs also. They were competing with the government. It was too late. The government at this point just saw the church as a retrogressive organization, and Calles would have seen that as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So he was out to... So he did. He tried to destroy the Catholic unions. In fact, he succeeded in destroying the Catholic unions.
Wow.
And destroy that whole movement.
You know, I don't remember precisely when I first heard of Rerum Novarum, but I think it may have been Monsignor Coffey said you ought to read this, young man.
Right. It was the beginning of the social teaching of the popes. That was the beginning, and it was a very important encyclical.
What a document it is.
Yeah, very important at the time. Of course, in the context, it was extremely important
yeah.
at the time. He saw it as an answer to communism. He said, mm-hmm. look, communism is not the answer. The answer is to use Christian principles
right.
to have better conditions in the factories.
Yeah. Wow. So we're with Monsignor James Murphy talking about his new book, Saints and Sinners in the Cristero War. You've lived in Mexico?
On and off. And I was there for 6 months at one point and 3 months at another point. Yeah.
The the research that this is a fact-filled book, and as you were explaining to me before the show, Ignatius Press, boy, they cross all the T's and dot all the I's.
Ignatius Press is extremely strict, extremely strict. I followed the practice as an author. You have to put, if you quote somebody directly, you have to put down in the footnote exactly where you found that quote.
Right.
The name of the book, the publisher, and the year of publication. But that wasn't enough for them. They wanted some of the facts that I mentioned, that I stated. They say, where did you find that fact?
Right.
And I had to go back and try to remember, where did I read that? And then what page was it on that I read it? So I'd put a lot of extra footnotes in. And then in some places I would quote the New York Times, let's say, August of 1926, and they'd say, what's the title of the article?
Wow.
And who was the author?
Wow.
I had to go down to the state library here. And the state library, by the way, the staff are so helpful down there. They're wonderful at the state library. And look up the back
are
issues.
Are these bound versions or is it all online?
It's on that machine.
Yeah. God,
it's so hard to read that thing.
It's so hard
to read that thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Osservatore Romano, the Vatican newspaper, again, I tried to look at back. They made me go back and get some of those. I couldn't do it because they don't have all of their stuff on that.
Right.
What do you call that?
Microfilm.
Microfilm. They don't have it on microfilm.
Yeah.
So they let me away with that one. They said, okay, we won't ask you to go to Rome and look at the original issues.
I remember working the newspaper I worked for in Davis. They had the feature like 100 years ago today in the Davis Enterprise,
Right.
And we had to take turns.
Go back
once
and check.
A week, go back and check, and we go to the library, and I go, no, that wasn't a good night. And you turn it, and it goes so fast, you get nauseous.
Yeah, you do. And you can't get the full page if you get only one article. To get the whole page, it's harder to get the whole page.
Right. And, hard stuff.
But I just think Ignatius Press is marvelous. I really admire their high standards, and I was honored to be part of it, and I had fun working with the staff.
Yeah. So in terms of you mentioned the New York Times, 1926. Was there a lot of attention in the American press to what was going on?
Oh, there was quite a bit, especially in the Catholic press. And I had the help of two wonderful people, Deacon Jerry Pauley and his wife Barbara, who were over at Immaculate Conception Parish. They just took an interest in this project, and they went down to the Catholic Herald, looked at the back issues of those years, and they traced all the articles in the Catholic Herald about the Cristero War and before and after.
Wow.
And that was giving me a bird's eye view of an average diocesan newspaper from the United States, how they would have covered it. And I quoted those articles in the book. I could never have done that if I hadn't had that research done by Jerry Pauley and Barbara.
And our own Catholic Herald goes back to what? To
1908.
Late
1908, yeah. But there was a lot of attention, there had to be, because the bishops were living in San Antonio, Texas, and the guests of the local bishop there. And there was even Caius himself, he had one of his people in the embassy here write an op-ed in the New York Times justifying himself, and then they would give Father John Burke's point of view as well. They were aware of it, yes.
What was the toughest part of writing this book? Researching it, just putting it together. We're talking, how many pages is it? 270 plus the bibliography. It'd take me a year just to put together the bibliography.
Finding a publisher was the hardest part. It really was. It's one thing to write a book, but then you have to have a publisher. And, I was going to work with Liguri Press, which I had worked with 10 years ago when I wrote a smaller pamphlet or booklet on Toribio Romo. Got back to them, and they did take the manuscript and they read it, and then got back to me and said that, look, no, we don't do these things anymore. We don't do history. We do just parish material. So then I...
one of those not quite right for us letters?
Yes, right. And I was kind of surprised, a bit disappointed, crestfallen.
Yeah.
So then I contacted Father Fessio.
You had the manuscript done at this point.
Oh, it's all done, fully done. Oh, yes, fully done. And I was almost like a Hail Mary pass, but they got back to me and said, yes, we'll take it.
Father Fessio was the founder of Ignatius Press.
Yes.
And still very active in it, and a Jesuit.
And you have him on here regularly on the program.
We have him on regularly, and he's most gracious with his time. And it's just, he speaks from the heart, but he speaks off the cuff, too.
Right.
He's very, he just says it.
But they have an incredible organization. Yes. Apparently, according to the internet, they publish about 20 books a year. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Oh, it is, yeah.
So mm-hmm. you have to basically line up. I mean, once you get accepted and the process of production starts, you have to line up behind several others. And
they're out of San Francisco.
Out of San Francisco. But the person I was dealing with, all of course through email, was back east. Uh-huh. So they seem to have workers working from their homes. Yeah. But everything is done through email, everything. I've never met any of them. Amazing. The whole thing is done by email.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I think it's very common now for editors to be wherever they are and they work from home.
And you get I feel like I know them. Yeah. I never met them.
It's just tangential to it, but I remember reading a story in the New York Times, and they were talking about a McDonald's drive-through in Santa Barbara. And you come up and you say, would you be sure that they put extra ketchup on that? And it turns out that you're talking to a person at home in North Dakota who is like covering maybe 10 or 12 McDonald's and knows which McDonald's they're talking to. Oh, nice day today, huh?
Incredible.
It's 80 in Santa Barbara and it's 20 below in Fargo.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. Mind-boggling.
But I would love to go to San Francisco and just go to their headquarters just to see the place.
Yeah, it's probably one door. Yeah. You know,
I don't know.
You never know. But boy, they do put out a lot of great stuff. So your royalties, such as they are,
I want them to go towards my favorite charity, which is Cristo Rey High School in Sacramento.
Are the words "Viva Cristo Rey" in here somewhere?
There are in there. The words "Viva Cristo Rey." That phrase, "Long live Christ the King," was their battle cry of the Cristeros. And it still brings tears to people who remember or whose family remembers.
Right.
And, of course, the word Cristero originally was thought up as an insult. It was the federal troops who considered these fanatical, superstitious Catholics ridiculous, called them Cristeros. Mm-hmm. Then the Cristeros said, well, you know, this is an act, this is an honor to have this title. We're disciples of Christ. And so they embraced it, and then they became the Cristeros.
Yeah. I think I was in a church in Sacramento, and I can't remember the name of it, that had a monument, but a recognition of Toribio Romo.
Oh, yeah, Immaculate Conception does, for sure.
Yeah,
he's well known here because of the family. He's about 300 cousins here, all from Jalisco, from the Santa Ana area. And every year they have a big mass plus a meal in the park. And they have a huge, big family tree. It's about 20 feet long, and they put it up, and they trace themselves back all the way to several centuries. The Romos, and there's Perez's, there's Martins, there's Gonzalez's, different branches of the family.
Wow. And, of course, the former famous Dallas Cowboys quarterback, Tony Romo. I wonder if he's related.
Oh, I wonder, yeah. Same name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about Cristo Rey High School, why you picked them.
Well, it's a wonderful project. Cristo Rey High School, you have to be poor to qualify to get there. You have to be below a certain income. If you qualify to go to Christian Brothers or to Jesuit or St. Francis, you can't go to Cristo Rey.
Right.
I mean, that says it all about their mission. And they have, you know, they have mostly Mexican. It's about 95% Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone there and gone to the classrooms and tours and to see those clean-cut kids all studying science and English and all the other languages, including religion. It's just very moving. And then the model is that they spend one day a week in working for some business.
Working all day.
And the business sponsors the child, the student.
And they're not flipping burgers.
The front desk. And let's say some attorney firm downtown, they'll put the kid on the front desk, and he has to come in dressed properly.
Right.
And he has to answer the phone and meet the public.
And some of them work in the legislature.
I mean, that's an education in itself.
Yeah.
And those kids are all going on to college. So it's an enormously successful organization, founded by a Jesuit, by the way.
Right.
Although locally, the Mercy Sisters are very involved.
Out of Chicago, I think. Father Foley?
Could be correct, out of Chicago. It's just an admirable project.
Yeah, I remember my wife, Shelley, early on in Cristo Rey, was the one who would go out and find the businesses, find the law firms, and make the presentation. Would you like to sponsor a student? Would you like to?
Yeah.
And So we have been to a number of Cristo Rey events, and you're right. It's just these kids are, I remember going to one of their crab feeds, and I thought I was at a fancy the way the attention the kids and the kids were all the waiters and waitresses.
Yeah,
you know, and to see the jobs that they do, and how a lot of these firms, they don't want to let them go, and they all virtually all go on to college.
Yeah, and when it came to Sacramento, it was during Bishop Wiggins' time. Bishop Wiggins brought them here. There was a recession going on, and I wondered. I was quite nervous. I wondered, will this thing survive?
Right.
Yeah, but it did.
I remember interviewing Father Foley, and he said, "You know, we sat down in Chicago with a bunch of businessmen." And he said, we had no idea if this would work. Absolutely no idea, but and I don't really know. I mean, it was his, he founded it, but he said he had a lot of help. And it worked in Chicago, and now there's, I mean, I think there were, 30 or 40 of them around the country, something like that. And this one has flourished. I have a new campus now. And
well, I'll tell you, whatever few shekels I have when I die, it's good. They're going to Cristo Rey.
They're doing remarkable. I went to their very first graduation. And it was at St. Ignatius, and Bishop Wiegand was officiating at the they had a mass, and then the graduation, and Father Foley came out from Chicago, and it's the first graduation I've ever cried at that didn't involve one of my own kids. You know,
I can understand.
So beautiful. Yeah, I mean, virtually every kid in that class was the first one in their family going on to college, and many times the first one to graduate from high school.
Do you know from Father Foley, why did he pick Cristo Rey? Was he thinking of the Cristero War?
I don't know. I should have asked him that question.
I wonder about that.
You just say,
there's no obvious connection.
No, but...
yet you could say there is a connection.
It may well be because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Viva Cristo Rey.
But it is a fabulous, fabulous...
project.
It's a wonderful
enterprise
model. And you look at the Sacramento people who were involved, not just in providing jobs, but their board of directors and all that. You're talking about a who's who in Sacramento. There's a lot of it.
You are
big time people aboard on that thing.
Right.
So Monsignor, people can get this book at the Catholic store? Easter's probably?
Yes, the Catholic store on Broadway is going to have a signing of the book on the 30th of March at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a Saturday. I'll be there. And they'll have extra copies to sell as well. But you can bring your copy also, and I can autograph it on the 30th of March, 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. 30th of March, a Catholic store about 19, right by the railroad tracks on Broadway.
Yep.
Yeah, very good. And of course, you can go to Ignatius.com too and order it through them as well.
And Amazon.
And Amazon as well. Monsignor, thanks so much, Bob, for being with us. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
God has said that I am a masterpiece, and I believe God, but I need guidance. When you say you don't give to the church, but give through the church, I need you to teach me what that means. Show me how I can serve others through the church. Give mercy through the church. Learn what my gifts are. Teach me wisdom, understanding, and grace, so I may serve others and God through the church.
I'm Doreen. This is my husband, Hutch. We have two young boys, 8 and 3. The car fire had been going on for a few days, and we didn't really think much of it coming into Reading. And before I knew it, I look out and there's fire, and it's coming down the mountain, and it looked like lava. The power went out, and that's when I knew that we had to get out of there. We got to come back to see if our home was still standing, just like a black and white film, driving into a black and white film. And there was no life. There were no birds, no trees left, just blackened, everything gone, no life at all.
My name's Jackie, and I'm a volunteer and visitor for the St. Vincent de Paul Society in Reading. When the fire came to Reading, the car fire, we were part of the local assistance relief center, and now we're working on long-term help of housing, furniture, appliances, things that they need to pick up their life again.
Our community knows about St. Vincent de Paul because they're there for everybody if they need help. And I spoke with Jackie, and she took down all of our information, and she said that she would love to help us, and they were helping so many families. They got us dressers for the boys, and they're really excited about that. Beds for the boys, box spring for us, things that would have taken a long time for us to get on our own. When we first got our dining room table, to actually sit down at the table and have a meal together instead of sitting on the floor in the car and eating.
The two parishes that make up St. Vincent de Paul in Reading are Our Lady of Mercy and St. Joseph. I became involved with St. Vincent de Paul because I felt the need to help people. Her family has been a joy to work with and help.
We are so thankful for what St. Vincent de Paul and the whole community has done to help us. They were really here for us in our time of need, and it was an amazing feeling to feel their love.
I am thankful that I have so much and never go hungry, but I know there are others not so fortunate. Others who don't have a family filling them with love and so many other things. Teach me compassion for others less fortunate.
I was about 8 years old when I first came to Stanford. I knew our life was abnormal, I just didn't know why. So I was like, I just wish we were normal, kind of, as a kid. My name's Julie Ross, and I'm a married, mother of four. I have three daughters and a son. I grew up in Gardenland. My parents, they were both drug addicts. Growing up in that environment, it taught me to be really independent, and if I needed something, I would ask for it myself. Like, if I needed attention, I would, Mom, give me a hug. I didn't expect it. I would go seek it, I guess. I believe that Stanford taught us how that you could be a part of something, but it doesn't have to be something negative. Like, we can all be, you know, feel loved at Stanford and be a part of that and see some, like, normal ways. And we saw, like, you don't really have to be part of the gang because you're gonna be, you know, go to prison or become a drug addict. I feel like at Stanford, Julie, she's seen the kids struggle. She's worked with a lot of different children, so she knows how to help people that nobody else wants to really help.
I'm Julie Roten. I'm the assistant director of Stanford Settlement Neighborhood Center, and I've worked here for 29 years. The kids consider this their safe place in the community. When something's unusual happening in their lives and they don't know who to turn to, they turn to their workers here at Stanford Settlement to help them. They show us by their behavior how life is impacting them. Sometimes that behavior gets them in trouble at school or at home, and so it's our job in our program to help kids learn the words to describe their feelings and learn a different way to manage their feelings besides acting them out and getting into trouble.
Julie, she helped me get my birth certificate so I can get a job. So I think getting a job and making my own money, it really helped me to become independent. I just want to thank the Catholic Appeal for helping Stanford stay afloat and to grow and to help more children and to be a good role model for the community.
We're all part of one body of Christ. Paul said in his letter to the second letter to the Corinthians that we are that one body, and we're baptized into that body. And so we can't separate ourselves from those who are suffering.
I am Deacon Kevin Stasko from St. Lawrence Parish in North Highlands.
I'm Paula Stasko. We are absolutely called to give to every member and to help those who need us the most, not the ones who are easy to help, but the ones who need us the most. And so that's why Kevin and I and our family chooses to support and be part of the annual Catholic Appeal.
There's a sense that we don't give to the church, that we give through the church. The church's mission in the world is to build the kingdom, to reach out to others, to spread God's love everywhere. And we do that by giving our gifts and talents, giving our money to the church, and the church passes that on to those in need.
If I am to be like Jesus, teach me, God, about my faith. Show me and my family how to serve others with our gifts, talents, and generosity.
This is Jaime Soto, Bishop of the Diocese of Sacramento. Our annual Catholic Appeal is solely dedicated to the social mission of the Church. I am inspired by your unwavering generosity year after year. As the disciples of Jesus, we choose not to be indifferent to the sorrows and anguish of those who are poor or in pain. We commit ourselves to be part of the saving work of Jesus. Join me in making a sacrificial pledge this year so that our neighbors in need may experience the healing, hopeful presence of Jesus in Northern California.
Underwriting for the Bishop's Hour is provided by Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services, a ministry of the Diocese of Sacramento. As a church-owned nonprofit founded in faith, Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services is dedicated to providing education, support, and resources during life's most difficult moments. They will make every effort to enable you to realize your final wishes while empowering families to make completely informed decisions. You can give them a call. They're at 855-525-2285. That's 855-525-2285. We're also brought to you by a generous grant from Christine Cipperly, marriage and family therapist. If you're looking for help with family or personal problems, if you'd like help from someone with a Catholic point of view, someone who understands the importance of marriage and family and affirms the dignity of every human life, Christine Cipperly is a trained and experienced counselor of married couples, families, and individuals. She can work with you on your marriage, your parenting, or your individual struggles in a way that will not violate our faith. Christine is a wonderful, wonderful therapist. Give her a call. She's at 530-400-4757. That's 530-400-4757. We'd like to thank Christine Cipperly and Catholic Cemeteries and Funeral Services for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. God bless. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Standing
You might.